Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me for a few minutes as we continue to pour through some historical baseball cards and in some cases some hysterical baseball cards, but we've got a good one here, a good story, and a good set, although it's not one of my favorites. In fact, in terms of design, I think it's really one of the most lackadaisical ones that Topps put together. But there are some good reasons behind that, and also there are some reasons why some people like this particular set. We're talking about 1961 Topps set, and our random pull is card number 216, the Penticton Peach, Ted Bosfield, who is still alive and kicking in the hills of British Columbia. Ted Bosfield of the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. And that is a compliment because he is not only a Hall of Famer in Canada, but he helped blaze the path for other British Columbian-born players to make it to the major leagues. Also, he has a very interesting history because if you look at where Penticton is on the map of Canada and the province of British Columbia, you can see that it's amazing Ted Bosfield ever got onto a baseball diamond, never mind the major leagues, and never mind a pretty serviceable career in the bigs, including one with the expansion Los Angeles Angels. And we'll talk about the expansion of 1961. You know, it's a big change for the American League in particular, Major League Baseball overall. And Ted Bosfield was a big part of that, and he had a very interesting path to the big leagues, a very interesting path out of the big leagues, and we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. First, we're going to talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, your 24/7 home for everything about the hobby. You could talk about our podcast, you could talk about the players we discuss in the podcast, you could talk about the sets, or just anything in general about the hobby. We certainly encourage you to strike up a conversation. We have some very interesting conversations going on here in the last few days, including a couple of, let's say, flashback conversations. One going back to our Flashback Friday episode, which we played for you this past weekend. And that was the 1990 Fleer set, which is one of my personal favorites for a number of reasons, not only because I think it's a real nice looking set, but also because I have a very personal connection. If you listen to that podcast, it's just one of those sets all these years later. I remember especially Sundays, you know, after my family would go to church, there was a grocery store across the street from our church that we would often stop by afterwards and pick up a few groceries. And there was a pretty big baseball card display, and I would go there every Sunday. And it seems like every Sunday I would go home with a cello pack of 1990 Fleer baseball cards. So even though it is in the middle of the junk wax era, and you can find 1990 Fleer packs pretty cheap these days, and you can be inundated with them, and they're not very valuable. To me, there's a lot of sentimental value to that set. And of course, our random pull from that podcast was John Smoltz. And Smoltzy was just starting his phenomenal career in 1990. And as we mentioned in the podcast, he's the one that got away from the Detroit Tigers, the infamous, and I do mean infamous, Doyle Alexander trade. But as we explained, the whole deal with that trade, the Tigers pushing for a playoff run in 1987. You look at John Smoltz's numbers in 1987, they weren't extremely special. Nothing really jumped out at you, but of course he turned into just an absolutely dominant pitcher. And he's a hell of a broadcaster these days, too. And I think America kind of woke up to that in the World Series last year in particular. But anyways, as for comments on our podcast, Sports Carter writing us a few days ago, neat element in the 87 to 90 Fleer were parts of the picture overlapping the border. And that's something that I pointed out not only in the 1990 Fleer podcast, but yeah, if you listen to 89 and 88 and 87, we get into detail about that. And especially the 87 Fleer podcast, where our random poll was Kent Ticholvi, that's where I noted that the FLIR people went out of their way to kind of give this three-dimensional element to their cards, even though in 1987, 3D technology was very, very, very primitive compared to design technology these days. In fact, if you go back to the mid to late 80s, when you think of 3D design, I almost always think of Dire Straits' Money for Nothing music video, which was very revolutionary and cutting edge at the time. Of course, now you look at it and you go, wow, that's really outdated. It really shows this age. But the FLIR cards in 1987 didn't. They were able to seamlessly put in these pictures with their design to make the players kind of stand out above the design borders, and in many ways had that third dimension. It didn't scream at you, but it was very subtle, and they did a great job at doing that. So I'm glad you saw that, Sports Carter, and it is one of the neat little perks of the late 80s and early 90s FLIR sets. Before everybody else started doing it, Topps picked up on it very quickly. In fact, they started doing it in 1988. Now, as for another flashback, Ryan Stonebreaker, talking about 1987, he says, I picked up some 1987 Topps and an 87 FLIR set for a 30-year story I am writing. Well, Ryan, I'm looking forward to that. Make sure that you tweet us a link to that story when you're done. But he goes on to continue, I forgot the number of Hall of Famers and MVPs I saw as a kid. And the 87 sets are perfect for that nice little window of an incredible Hall of Fame class and an incredible, as you put it, MVP, but I'll put it as rookie and young star class. And, that also happened in, I want to say, like 1992-93, where you had a nice little cross-section of veteran players and, some up-and-coming players. But 87 really is a very interesting tipping point. And it happens, like I said, every 5-6 years in the hobby, you kind of get that window, kind of shuffling around there. But you look back at 87, and you had still playing and still racking up numbers in their Hall of Fame careers. Pete Rose, okay, well, he's not in the Hall of Fame, but for various reasons we're already well aware of. But also, you had Jim Rice, you have Mike Schmidt, you had Nolan Ryan, you had Carlton Fisk, you had Tom Seaver was wrapping up his career. I mean, you had a lot of outstanding stars from the late 60s and early 70s. And then, of course, George Brett and Robin Yount, and Paul Molitor, and Dale Murphy. So you have the stars of the mid to late 70s. And then you had the stars of the early 80s, who were really starting to rise up here. And of course, talking about Ripken and Boggs and Henderson and Gwynn and Sandberg and, the young stars, Bo Jackson, Dwight Gooden, Daryl Strawberry. I mean, just a tremendous cornucopia of stardom of various generations all coming together in 1987. So that's one of the fun things. I think that's another reason why, in particular, 87 Topps, but also the 87 FLIR and Donruss sets are still collector favorites, not only because they look nice and they have a classic appeal to them, and that's all three sets, but of course the Topps set really stands out all these years later. But you look at the star assortment, and it's not just the rookies, it's the legendary players. And even though the set was made in 1987, you had players from 20 years before who were still making an impact, not only on the hobby, but in Major League Baseball. And that's a very, very neat thing. And like I said, the window opens in this kind of situation every 5, 6, 7 years, because if you go back to, say, 83, that's when you had the big three rookie cards of Gwynn and Sandberg and Boggs. And you also still had some of the star players from the mid-60s contributing. You had some of the young star players from the mid to late 70s. And then if you shift that window forward a few years from 1987, like I said, 92, 93, same thing. Nolan Ryan was wrapping up his career. Carlton Fisk is wrapping up his career. And you had, the early stars of the early 80s were in the prime of their careers. But then you had Mike Piazza and Frank Thomas and Roberto Alomar and John Smoltz and Tom Glavine and all the other greats that would go on to dominate the sport and the hobby throughout the 1990s. So it's neat when you're looking at a set that's right in the middle of that window of legendary players, Hall of Fame players from 15, 20 years prior, to young stars in the prime of their careers, to outstanding rookies who would have great 10, 15, 20 year runs in the future. So a great observation there, Ryan. And again, make sure you send us a link to your article when you get it done at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, as for our most recent podcast on 1960 Tops, where our random poll is Johnny Temple, Bob Andrews says, nice job. I love the 1960 set. Sends us a tweet about 1960 Tops blog. So you are a big fan of the 1960 Tops set. And I did check out the blog. Some great work there. And appreciate you commenting on the podcast. Also, Wax Pack 916, great podcast. This is one of my favorite vintage sets. I like the design a lot. I enjoy hearing about the lesser name random pulls. And this is something that I've mentioned in previous podcasts. And I even, if you go back to our tail end of the Big Old Monster Box podcast, the 1992 and 93 sets, we had mostly star players because those are the cards that I hung on to from the end of the junk wax era. You know, we all have boxes of these random cards from then, and some of us got rid of them, some of us still have them, but I hung on to the superstar cards, so we featured podcasts on some of these superstar players from the early 90s. But my favorite stories come from the guys that you may not know much about. You tend to get the best stories out of guys that aren't necessarily household names. And that's certainly the case with the player that we're going to talk about today, Ted Bosfield, and 1961 Topps. So we'll get to that in just a little bit. But I'm glad you're enjoying these random pulls. I can tell you that as we go through, especially the 1960s, you're going to have more unfamiliar names, but some pretty interesting stories that we get. And then I think once we get into the 70s, you'll start getting some more familiar players kind of shuffling right back in. Not necessarily the Hall of Fame players. Who knows, some of the random pulls we may get, you know, a Steve Carlton or something like that. But chances are it's going to be somebody that you haven't heard of or haven't heard much of. And I enjoy doing the digging, looking for some of the interesting stories that arise from those particular cards. So thanks for the comment, Wax Pack 916, and continued success on your Hall of Fame 1960 Tops collection that you shared with us. And again, you could share anything about the Wax Ecstatic podcast, the players we talk about, the sets we talk about, or anything about the hobby on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Again, please share the Twitter feed with your collecting friends, even those who don't collect these days, but maybe they collected 15, 20, 25 years ago. It's always fun to look back at the hobby, even if you're not a very active collector. And we encourage all sorts of collectors to join in the conversation here. And please remind them that Wax Ecstatic comes your way every Tuesday with new episodes as we continue to go through the big old binder again through the 1960s over the next few weeks. And we come your way via Audio Boom, also iTunes, and iHeartRadio. So if you have the iHeartRadio app, or iTunes, or Audio Boom, simply search Wax Ecstatic and you will find us. Favorite us, comment on us, like us, whatever you have to do to spread the word, please do. As we've seen some tremendous growth over the last few months, we enjoy telling these stories and sharing our opinions with you, and then you in turn sharing your opinions with us. So it's a nice little two-way street we got going here, and I owe a lot of it to you for just simply word of mouth, passing along the story of Wax Ecstatic to all of the collectors worldwide via Wax Ecstatic and our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, before we get into the story of Ted Bosfield, again, a Canadian Hall of Famer and a very interesting fellow before, during, and after his major league career, let's talk a little bit about the 1961 top set and what makes it unique. And I kind of panned the set at the tail end of our 1960 Tops podcast. And let me put it to you this way. 1961 Tops, this one definitely falls in the category of you either love it or you don't. Much like, and this is based on podcasts I've already done, you can make this argument for several other sets, but 81 Tops, 82 tops, 86 tops, 88 tops. And that's just the tops episodes. You know, you can make this case for Fleer and Donruss sets and other sets throughout the history of baseball card collecting. But in the 81 tops example, I liked it. A lot of people don't. The next year, 82 tops, I didn't really care for. A lot of people do. So this is really kind of a black or white situation. You either like it or you don't. I have never been a big fan of 61 tops. And here's the reason why. Of course, we have 2020 vision of 50 plus years of looking back at the glory days of tops, in particular the 1960s. And it really starts in the late 1950s after they bought out Bowman and pushed them aside. Tops just went crazy with innovations and designs. The collector favorite 55 and 56 sets, the groundbreaking 57 top set, the very artsy and, as I described in the 1959 tops podcast, Mad Men-esque, very marketing and ad agency like 58, 59, and 60 sets. And the 1960 set, as I recently pointed out, had a lot of elements from the 1950s sets that I just mentioned, all combined into one look here. So you have that, and then, let's cheat a little bit. If you look forward to the next few sets, 62, 63, 64, 65 tops, incredible sets for design, for rookies, for stars, for scarcity. This was the sweet spot in tops history. You go from 55 to 65. And yeah, I know, 52 tops, you had the Mantle rookie card. In the late 60s, you had some big rookie cards and big star cards. But when you look at the glory days of tops, you're looking from 55 to 65. You had some great designs, some really forward-thinking went into, a lot of these sets. 61 tops, in my opinion, didn't have that. Now, 61 tops, even though it didn't have the design elements of some of the late 50s or some of the mid-60s designs that tops had, some people will call it simple. I call it boring. And again, this is kind of the thin line between if you like it or you don't. If you're like me and you don't like it, it's because you look at it and go, well, it looks like I'm looking at, a baseball player through a window pane. That's pretty much it. It's just like, yep, there's a picture of Frank Robinson. Yep, there's a picture of Mickey Mantle. And they're all pose shots, and they're all, for the most part, very closely cropped pictures of these baseball players. There's back then they didn't have action shots, but, a lot of the pose shots, were from afar. It was a player, following through a windup for a pitch or following through in a swing at home plate. There was some action to it, but 1961 tops for the most part are just headshots. So to me, that's not very exciting. And then you look at the card, and we'll take a look at the 61 tops card that we have here of Ted Bosfield. Again, the random pull card number 216. And you have a white border. You have about 90% of the card devoted to the picture of the player. You have his name in the lower left-hand corner in a little rectangular box, along with his position. And then in the lower right-hand corner, you have another rectangle with the team that he plays for. And that's it. And to me, it's just lacking a lot, especially, again, when you're coming off of, in particular, 58, 59, 60, where you have lots of color, lots of design, lots of logos. You've got mixed shots being put in here. You look at 61, you go, wow, that's kind of plain. And again, we kind of have the element of looking back at the past, knowing what was coming in 62 and 63 and 64 and 65. Some of Topps' most famous designs were coming after this. So with that perspective, you can look at this and go, okay, it's not that great. So if you're of the side that thinks that 61 Topps is really nothing to get excited about, that's your thinking. It's kind of boring. It's kind of bland. There were some great sets before it. There would be some great sets after it. So, you know, 61 tops is nothing to really get excited about. Now, the flip side is you have some collectors that go 61 tops is a classic because it is simple. And you're right in that it's simple. There is not a whole lot of bells and whistles going on here with 61 tops. As I described the card, and as I said, if you look at the random pull that we have here, or if you look at any 61 tops card, the base cards, not like the Sporting News All-Stars or the Baseball Thrills cards, which do have a little bit of pizzazz to them, but just the basic player cards are very, very, very plain. And some people will see that and go, this is simple, this is clean, I like it. And I can see that perspective. And especially from 57 Tops. You know, I called 57 Tops groundbreaking. It's one of the legendary sets. And you may be going, well, Matt, if you like 57 Tops, why are you, you know, crapping all over 61 Tops? Well, I think the big reason is because, again, historical perspective. 57 Tops, first set to use real color photography, and they dedicated, you know, basically the entire front of the card to the shots of players just standing in the ballparks doing these posed shots. There was something, though, that was real and risky about the 57 Tops set going in this direction. Whereas 61 Tops, I feel, even though they're using full color shots, it's players standing around. Again, the closely cropped shots, there's some that are just, you know, especially Ted Bosfield here, you know, here he is basically with just a very blank expression. There's just not a lot of energy from these particular shots. And in 1961, I think Topps played it safe. Now, there's a very good reason. We'll get into that in a moment. But that's where I differ. If you say, well, if you like 57 Topps, why don't you like 61 Topps? 57 Topps, it seemed like they were pushing the envelope. They were really trying to do something really innovative and different and groundbreaking. 61 Tops, it feels like they're pulling back a little bit. It's like, well, we really shouldn't get too crazy here. And they just kind of held back a little bit. I think that's the issue there. So 57 Tops groundbreaking, 61 Tops not so much. Well, why is that? Well, if you're a historian or if you're a fan of baseball history, you know that 1961 was the year of the first expansion in Major League Baseball. And remember, too, back then, you know, Major League Baseball was the basically umbrella organization that housed the American League and National League. And in the 1960s, the American League and National League were two very distinctly different leagues. They played under Major League Baseball, but they were ruled differently. You had presidents of the leagues, you have owners of the leagues that didn't necessarily do what was in the best interest of quote-unquote Major League Baseball, but what was in the best interest of the American League and the National League. And that would actually continue really up until, I would say, the early 90s when Bud Selig took over as commissioner of the Major League Baseball owners. And that's kind of where the line between the AL and the NL kind of got faded out there, and really Major League Baseball has been, you know, this collection of 30 teams since then, and even though there is an American League and National League, the difference between the two with interleague baseball and talk about the DH coming to the National League, it's really been obliterated, you know, all these years later. But in 1961, the American League was looking to jump into Los Angeles, and you had the Dodgers were already there. The Giants were in San Francisco. So you had two teams relocating from New York to California for a couple of reasons. One, because the owners could have better deals out there, break virgin territory when it came to Major League Baseball. But also the bigger factor was squashing the hopes of the Pacific Coast League, which was, again, another major league, just not part of Major League Baseball. The hopes of the PCL getting to, MLB status. So the Giants and the Dodgers move out there. They, bring Major League Baseball, the official Major League Baseball to the Golden State. And, that's that pretty much, the PCL starts going downhill shortly thereafter and is basically just a glorified minor league for many years to come. Well, it just so happens that Calvin Griffith, the longtime owner of the Washington Senators, had been looking to get out of Washington, and this was no secret. He was looking to do it for many, many years. Well, he has his eyes on Minneapolis-St. Paul. Now, let's back up the story a little bit here. Minneapolis-St. Paul was going to be the future destination of the New York Giants. Follow me here. Horace Stoneham had bought the Minneapolis Millers, the International League AAA ball club, and they built a brand new stadium, Metropolitan Stadium, in, I believe it was 1956. And it wasn't just Horace Stoneham and the Giants. There were some local politicians and newspaper writers who lobbied to get this brand spanking new stadium built in the middle of Bloomington, Minnesota. Now, the original layout for Metropolitan Stadium, I believe, had like 21,000 seats. So for a minor league ballpark, it was huge. And Metropolitan Stadium was designed so that it could be expanded in several different segments. And it would be over the years. Metropolitan Stadium not only hosted the Twins, but the Vikings for a long time. And by the time it closed in 1981, I think it had a capacity of like 46,000 seats. So anyways, there's this big minor league stadium waiting for a major league tenant. Starting in, I think, 1956, the Giants were going to move there, but Walter O'Malley talks Stoneham into going to California as opposed to Minnesota. So the poor people in Minnesota are just sitting there waiting with this ginormous minor league stadium, waiting for a team to come by. Well, Calvin Griffith has been looking at Minneapolis for a long time, and even though the politicians would rather have a first-class ball club like the Giants or Dodgers moving there, hey, it's the Senators, okay, they're not a very good team, but it's major leagues, okay, we'll do this. So there's a little dance going on between Griffith and Minneapolis, but the American League doesn't want to leave Washington, D.C. alone. They want to have a club there because, well, Washington, D.C., it still is a large metropolitan market. It was a large metropolitan market back in the early 60s, made up of a completely different clientele, different type of resident. Now if you say you live in Washington, D.C., you actually live in Fairfax. But, back then, if you lived in Washington, D.C., you actually lived there and you actually worked there. So the American League doesn't want to give up a team in D.C., and they certainly didn't want to leave a gaping hole for the National League to move in, because the National League was going to add a team to New York City, the Mets, which would happen in 1962. But they could have very easily just swooped right on in, taken over the Washington franchise, and the American League would be SOL. Losing a top 10 market, losing the nation's capital, and losing a key East Coast city. So if the American League wanted to expand, then they'd have to, settle for some kind of secondary city. The expansion dance starts going on really in the late 50s. Again, once Stoneham and the Giants move out to California, Minnesota's looking for a tenant for Metropolitan Stadium, and you start having this series of musical chairs. Now, a lot of this backstory comes from Vec as in Rec, the book that I spoke about in the 1954 Topps podcast. Vec as in Rec, if you want to skip all the way, I believe it's chapter 22. It's called How We Brought the Minor Leagues Back to Los Angeles. Phenomenal step-by-step recounting of the process by the late Bill Vec. And of course, he was recounting this literally a year or two after it happened. Vec as in Rec was originally released in 1962. So as for the Angels, and this is how it all ties into 61 Topps and Ted Bosfield here. As for the Angels, they were absolutely fleeced from the get-go, as Again, Vax supposedly had some people interested in Los Angeles to buy the club. Well, Walter O'Malley gets in there and just totally mucks up the process, and on purpose. Of course, you know, you've got this expansion team just dropping into his market. So he is able to fleece his guy, Gene Autry, into cash payments, into a really, arcane broadcasting deal. The Angels had to play in tiny Wrigley Field, which, yes, was basically a California version of the Wrigley Field in Chicago. It was where the TV show Home Run Derby was recorded. And why was Home Run Derby recorded there? Because it had some short fences, so the ball just flew out there very quickly. So, you know, the Angels had to play in this tiny bandbox stadium for 1 year. Then they had to be tenants of the new Chavez Ravine, which was, of course, O'Malley's Dodger Stadium, for the next 4 years before they got their own stadium, an Anaheim Stadium. So the Angels were put behind the eight ball for many, many years. So you've got this, this limping Angels team starting. You've got a new team in Washington starting. You've got the Minnesota Twins as well. So if you're Tops, you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place here, because you've got essentially three new teams, and you don't know what logos are going to look like. You don't know what their uniforms are going to look like. You don't necessarily know who the players are, because you have an expansion draft that happens in the winter of 1960. But with any expansion draft, some players that get drafted automatically get traded for more assets here. So Topps has a whole lot of balls in the air trying to figure out, okay, how do we produce a set? At least, how do we produce the first series or two of the 1961 set, but still address these three new teams in the expansion Angels and Senators and the new Minnesota Twins? So that is one big reason why 61 Topps is, in the fans' favorite, a simple set; in the not-so-fan favorite, you know, my opinion, a boring set, because they had to play it safe. They had no option. So you look at 61 Topps, you'll notice there's no logo on the front of the card. And that's one big reason why the front of the card looks pretty boring. Another thing is that you see a lot of these closely cropped shots, because who knows if the player photographed, and a lot of these pictures were taken, you know, over the previous two or three seasons. Who knows if the player that is photographed is going to be on that team of the jersey that they're wearing. So the 61 top set has a lot of cards, much like Ted Bosefield here, where the player doesn't have his hat on, or the photograph is taken at an angle to where you don't see the logo on the hat. You know, you see the underside of the hat bill and the player's face. And you have all sorts of these weird angles and croppings, and again, the hatless shots, to where they all look very nondescript. You know, only your star players like Mickey Mantle or Willie Mays, you know, all those guys aren't going to be playing for an expansion team, or the Minnesota Twins. You know, only the star players that you were certain were not going to be going anywhere were included with full uniform or a full, you know, well-positioned and designed action shot, or not really an action shot, a pose shot, I should say, as opposed to a lot of the other players that were in the set. So 61 Topps, there's a reason why they had to pull back, and that's because of the expansion. It's because of the movement of the Senators to Minnesota, and just a whole lot of questions as to exactly what was going on. Because remember, when Topps is designing the set and selecting photos and trying to lay out the different cards that are going to be in the different series, that's when the expansion draft is happening. That's when the movement of the Senators is happening. That's when so much uncertainty is up in the air, and Topps just had to go with a very basic design. I'm not a big fan of it, but some hobbyists are. And again, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, if you're a big fan of it, that's fine. I'm not going to say that you're wrong. I'm just going to say I'm not a big fan of it, and it's okay if you aren't. But that's the very long and winding backstory as to why Topps had to play it safe in 1961. They would also have to do it again in 1962, but they were a little more ambitious with the design in 1962 that made up for the lack of interesting photos, because again, you had expansion drafts with New York and Houston, or a lack of logos. They were able to make it up with a really compelling design that actually looks a lot like 1987 Topps, but they decided to go a little too safe, in my opinion, in 1961. Now let's flip the card over and take a quick look at the back of the card, as you have the horizontal layout. You also have a very easy-to-read design here. Up at the top, you've got the card number and the old Wild Wild West Tops, you know, the block letters above the card number. You have the player's name, personal information in a black box running along the top of the card. In this kind of a lime green backdrop, you've got the complete major league and minor league pitching record for Ted Bosfield, of course hitting record if you had a position player, and then if space allowed, you had some cartoons at the bottom. And this again goes back to the yin and the yang of the design of the back of the cards that Topps went through throughout the 1950s and into the early 1960s. And that is, it seems for odd number years, they would make some room for the cartoons and the complete professional statistic breakdown, while in the even number years, they would go with the one lines or two line, excuse me, career summary, where you had one line for the previous season and then one line for the career stats. So they would just kind of flip-flop and go back and forth and back and forth with this design element throughout the late 50s and into the early 1960s. But a very easy to read back here, very fun stuff too, like the cartoons. Look at this Ted Bosfield card. You know, Ted was drafted last December from the Indians. So here you have this, you know, Indian headdress kind of kicked off to the curb here, and you've got this guy with an angel's wings and halo. He attended college in Canada, and it has him, you know, on a dog sled going mush, you know, doing a little dog sledding with a baseball bat. And then one of the last cartoons here, Ted is a photography bug in his time off. Now, I've never heard of anybody being called a photography bug. Perhaps that's supposed to be a photography buff. But anyways, bug or buff, apparently Ted liked to take pictures when he was not towing the rubber in the major leagues. One other note about the 61 top set, I should point out, even though it was in terms of design not exactly a thrilling set, you had some pretty big rookie cards in this set. The late Ron Santo featured in this set. Also, his teammate Billy Williams and the high kick and Juan Marichal. The Mickey Mantle card, very popular in 1961 set as well. As card number two, Roger Maris. Of course, you had the home run swing off between these two teams, the controversy around Maris getting 61 in the new 162-game schedule, because with 10 teams, the schedule had to change in the American League from 154 to 162. But the Maris card, of course, also popular because being card number two in the set, that was an abused card, you know, with people, if they collected the cards and put them into sequential order, those were often at the top of the stack that were often rubber banded, but also there were plenty of those cards that were used and abused being in the first series. Those were the first cards that ended up in bike spokes or getting flipped. So very hard to find the mint condition Roger Maris card, but again, Mickey Mantle, card number 300, another card that is very, very popular, not only because it's the Mick, but also because it was 1961 and you had the Mantle and Maris chase going on then. And one other quick thing about 61 Topps here. There were a couple of interesting inserts. One, rub-off cards. So if you're a collector trying to find those rub-off cards, good luck, because you know, when you're dealing with a rub-off card that's over 50 years old, they're not in very good condition most of the time. According to one description, these are basically temporary tattoos, so that makes them even more flimsier. But also, there were some insert cards, you know, much like the box toppers that you see in today's Topps Heritage sets. Same thing here, where you just have these panel cards that were just kind of dropped into all the boxes. And that was just an incentive for, you know, grocery stores and drug stores and candy shops to buy more of these so that, you know, the store owner got something out of it too, other than just card sales or bubblegum sales, basically. They were able to get these little bonus cards thrown in there. And there's 208 different insert cards here in terms of the box toppers. So very hard to find them, but also very, very hard to find them in very good condition because, again, much like the rub-off cards, all these years later, not easy to find them in great shape. So the 61 top set, again, in my opinion, very meh, and again, you're looking at the design of the cards in the years before, and we knew what the design of the cards for the year after would be as we look back on the set. Topps could have done more. And like I said, they did more in 1962 when they were faced with a lot of the same challenges of the expansion draft and players being moved around. So in 61, I think they played it too safe. I'm not a big fan of it. It's a nice set, but I'm not a big fan of it. Others are a big fan of it because they go with, well, this is a simple set. And again, my argument against that is, well, 57 Topps was simple, but they seem to be pushing an envelope in 57, where in 61 they clearly were not. They were just kind of backing off and playing prevent defense here. So some people love it, some people not so much. I am of the latter. Be interesting to hear what you think about 61 Topps. Again, at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, put out your comments there. We'll share them with our fans in our next new podcast next Tuesday on 62 Topps. Now, as for Ted Bosfield, this is a very interesting story here. As you may have heard at the very beginning of this podcast, I called him the Penticton Peach. That was his nickname. Ted Bosfield of Penticton, British Columbia, in the great nation of Canada. Now, when most people, when you say British Columbia and Canada, the first place you think of is Vancouver. And you go, well, Vancouver's a pretty big city. Good for him. He made it to the big leagues. Well, Penticton, back in the 1940s and early 50s, when Ted was growing up there, Penticton was actually a very, very small town just south of Kelowna, British Columbia. As the crow flies, Penticton is about 70 miles east of Vancouver, but there is a mountain range between the two. And there's really no direct route from Vancouver to Penticton. So Penticton, again, just during World War II, post-war era, was a very, very tiny town. Population was, around 8,000 or 9,000. Penticton did not grow until really the 1950s. Post-war travel helped Penticton get on the map because it has become a resort village. It is located, like I said, on the eastern side of the BC Mountains, and you have a couple of lakes nearby, so it is a fishing and skiing resort town now. The fixed population in the mid-30,000. It's grown quite a bit, but going back again to the 1940s, very small town, and of course, being in Canada, baseball, while baseball is popular in Canada, hockey is Canada's sport. So in Penticton, small town surrounded by lakes, guess what the number one sport is? You got it. It's hockey, because those lakes would freeze over, and that's where the local kids played. And in fact, there are actually a lot of prominent current NHL players or recently current NHL players who played in Penticton. Brett Hull is one of them. Paul Kariya, another. There are several other, like I said, current or recently retired players who played at some point in time or lived at some point in time in Penticton who made it to the NHL. So the path to the NHL from Penticton, much more common than a path to Major League Baseball. So the story of Ted Bosfield begins with a Canadian boy growing up in a town that didn't even have a little league baseball league. They didn't have organized youth baseball. So Ted Bosfield got into the game because of his parents. And thanks to the website Cooperstowners in Canada, .com for a great backstory here, one of many sources that I've looked at. basically, Ted Bowersfield's parents really went all out to help him get his footing into baseball and at least get that path into the minor leagues, never mind the major leagues. And you may think that Ted Bowersfield's dad did all the heavy lifting, and he certainly did by all accounts. He reached out and would make sure that there were baseball tournaments that came through town that he could participate in, and he certainly did a lot of the heavy lifting. But it was Ted Bowersfield's mom who was really instrumental in his baseball career, because Ted Bowersfield's mom and two of her sisters played baseball professionally in Canada during World War II. And again, it was all part of, you know, with all of the men getting shipped overseas to fight in World War II, baseball teams to survive needed female players. And of course, you know, the female players didn't play for the major league teams, but they certainly filled roles, of course, in America in the Women's League of Professional Baseball. But throughout the country, even if you didn't make it through to the Women's League, you know, throughout the country and throughout North America, minor league teams, you know, city teams, sandlot teams, if there was a woman who could play half decent, she got on the team. So Ted Bowersfield's mom was a very popular player during World War II, as I mentioned, a couple of his sisters. So there was baseball already running through the Bowersfield family, but it wasn't from Mr. Bowersfield, it was Mrs. Bowersfield. So he had baseball in his blood, in his genes, in his background. So while Dad coordinated the games that were played in Tiny Penticton, certainly his mom had the experience and the know-how to show Ted the ropes. And Ted Bowersfield would become a pretty good all-round player, and eventually he would specialize in pitching. So finally, as a teenager, he's starting to get involved in some of these tournaments that came through. He was being tutored by another baseball success from the area, a young man named Sam Drosses. He was a prospect catcher. So you had scouts coming through town to watch Sam Drosses. Well, then Ted Bowersfield's there, so they were able to take some diligent notes on him. And finally, late in his teenage years, you're starting to get Rotary Club tournaments and stuff like that come through, so you get some bigger crowds, more scouts are coming through the area. So there's a Rotary tournament including Cuban All-Stars, and this is in the early 1950s, so this is before communist Cuba, but you've got some pretty good ball players playing for the Cuban team taking on this Rotary Club in Lethbridge, Alberta, and Ted Bowersfield is out there on the mound, and he strikes out 17 players in a game against Cuba. So that obviously gets the attention of some scouts here, because they're there, you know, monitoring the Cuban players and looking at, you know, some of the other Canadian kids that are coming through. Well, all of a sudden, here's this Bowersfield kid from British Columbia striking out 17 players. It's like, oh, well, okay. So according to the Cooperstowners in Canada story, the fact that he struck out 17 batters, the fact that Bowersfield was also a lefty, and that of course, will get your attention, he gets the attention of the scouts. Almost signs with Bill Veeck's St. Louis Browns. But with the Browns moving to Baltimore, the scout who was with St. Louis couldn't necessarily guarantee a deal because, as I mentioned, there was an ownership change with that move to Baltimore, too. So he, you know, there was a lot up in the air as to what he could do. So instead, Bowersfield signs a deal with the Boston Red Sox. So he makes his way up through the minor leagues, makes his debut in July of 1958. And he makes his major league debut in a very historical game. He starts his major league debut as a reliever, not as a starter, but he comes in relief. And he's on the other side of the box score for Jim Bunning's no-hitter for the Detroit Tigers that particular day. So Bowersfield in this article, by the way, jokes that at least he's in the U.S. Hall of Fame because of the box score. So that's a pretty funny way of looking at it. But Bowersfield becomes a pretty formidable southpaw for the Red Sox for the next few years, as one of the big reasons why Sox fans would absolutely love him, is that he could beat the New York Yankees. And it's funny, you look at his stats from 1958 and 1959, nothing spectacular stands out. 58 was his best year. He went 4-2 with a 3.84 earned run average, struck out 38, walked 36, and started 10 of 16 games that he appeared in. But he beat the Yankees three times in the 1958 season. So he was a player that Boston Red Sox fans could very easily like, because anytime you beat the Yankees, that's a good thing. Now, unfortunately, he started having some arm problems, was very inconsistent in the 1960 season, so he gets dealt to the Cleveland Indians in the middle of the 1960 season, and the Indians hang on to him basically as insurance going into the expansion draft in December of 1960. Now, here's a very interesting footnote to the expansion draft and Ted Bosfield's career. So he's drafted by the Angels with the 17th pick in the 1960 expansion draft. Well, later that same day, he is returned to the Indians. So this is one of those deals, and expansion drafts in all sports these days, the leagues have closed these type of loopholes. You know, a team could lose a certain number of players in the expansion draft. Well, the Indians lose Bosfield, but then they don't lose him because the Angels trade him back. Well, a couple months later, in fact, February 1st, 1961, the draft is completed by the Indians losing Bosfield to the Angels again. So I know this sounds all very confusing here, but basically the Angels are doing the Indians a favor, not once but twice, taking one of the unprotected players from the Indians, flipping him back to the Indians, and then relieving the Indians of a contract for a, you know, average pitcher going into the 1961 season. So you can say that Ted Bosfield was an original member of the Los Angeles Angels, but between the beginning of the draft and the end of the draft, for about 6 weeks, he was kind of in limbo there as a member, a de facto member of the Cleveland Indians. Well, anyways, and that makes the intrigue to the 61 Topps card even more interesting, because, you know, this card is being designed and printed probably in December or January. So, you know, poor Topps, you know, even though this is a later series card, poor Topps is probably not really sure what to do with this Ted Bosfield card, but they still have to produce a card and still have to, you know, create cards for these new Los Angeles Angels. Well, he does officially become a member of the Los Angeles Angels again right before the 1961 season starts, and he, in many ways, was their ace in 1961. He starts 21 games, appears in 41 games for the Angels, goes 11-8, has a 3.73 earned run average, strikes out 88, walks 63, gives up 18 home runs, but again, a lot of that is due to the tiny Wrigley Field in Los Angeles. And he moves on with the Angels into Chavez Ravine in 1962. Has a pretty decent season there, goes 9-8 with a 4.40 earned run average, 25 starts in 34 appearances. Now, after the 62 season, he is traded to the Kansas City Athletics. It was part of he was the player to be named later, basically completing the deal where the A's sent Dan Osinski to the Angels for cash. And that is where he wraps up his career after two seasons, 1963 and 1964. Overall, you know, his career numbers, 37-39, a 4.35 earned run average. Nothing to get too excited about, but again, he was the first British Columbian-born player to actually stick in the major leagues for a long time. And, you know, like I said, was basically the ace of the 61 Angels staff. But part of the reason why his career ended so shortly was he had arm problems. And, of course, medical technology in the mid-60s, primitive compared to what you have nowadays. Nowadays, they could, you know, repair the arm problems, and he probably could have pitched for another 7 or 8 years. But his career ends at 29 in the major leagues. But then his life takes an interesting turn, and I think this is a really more interesting part of the story here. He gets into stadium operations. So his career ends in Kansas City. He goes back to California and gets a job basically running the stadium, the new Anaheim Stadium, for the Angels for several years. It takes a similar position in Seattle with the new Mariners and the Kingdom in 1977. And does that for several years as well. And also, he became a stadium consultant with the Tacoma Dome in Tacoma, Washington. Also, BC Place Stadium in Vancouver, Toronto's Sky Dome, now known as Rogers Center. So Ted Bosefield, even though statistically maybe he doesn't stand out, or maybe he's one of the quote-unquote lesser-known players, but if you've spent a minute in Anaheim Stadium, or what is now called Angels Stadium in Anaheim, if you spent any time in the Old Kingdom or the Tacoma Dome, or if you've spent any time in BC Place in Vancouver or Rogers Center, well, guess what? Ted Bosefield, former pitcher for the Los Angeles Angels, the kid who grew up in tiny Penticton, British Columbia with no Little League team to play for, he had a part in the operations of all of those stadiums. And I think that's just absolutely amazing. You know, here's a guy who had a pretty, you know, okay career. And like I said, because he was the first British Columbian-born player to actually stick in the major leagues, he's in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. While his playing career is not known, and while this particular beat-up 1961 Topps card is, by all stretches of the imagination, a common card, this was not a common man. Had to battle to get into an organized team, which he didn't get to do until his late teens, was fortunate to have a whale of a game where Major League Scouts were at. He got signed by the Red Sox, gets to play in Boston, gets to play in Cleveland, gets to play in LA, gets to play in Kansas City. But for a good 20, 25 years after his playing career, he's either running or designing stadiums or stadium operations in Anaheim, Seattle, Tacoma, Vancouver, and Toronto. I think that's great. By all checks, Ted is still doing well, living in California. He is apparently a marshal and junior coordinator at Cypress Ridge Golf Course. So he's moved on from baseball stadiums to golf courses. Good for him. And alive and kicking at last check. He is currently 82 years young and living in California. Let me see, Napomo, California. Now, from the 61 Tops, we're going to take a look at 62 Tops next Tuesday. And 62 Tops, I really do like. Like I said before, it looks an awful lot like 1987 Tops. And I'm sure Tops was reaching back 25 years for that design. But 62 Tops has a very unique wood grain look to it that we'll talk about. Also, a very unique card back, which they would eventually abandon. They would only bring back one more time this similar card back, but basically the end of an era for how the backs of baseball cards were designed. And we'll do a random pull on that as well. So that is coming up next Tuesday. Also, a flashback Friday edition as we give you a chance to listen back to some of our older episodes. So look forward to that on Friday, and we will tweet out the link to it on Saturday and Sunday as well, just to remind you to give some of our older episodes a listen. Old episodes, new episodes available at audioboom.com, also via iTunes and iHeartRadio. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We will see you next time.